Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. Welcome, everybody, to Behind the Curtain. This is Paul Listnick, and what a show we have planned for you. That music, of course, one of my favorite songs. It brings me to tears every time I hear it, including actually now, when we just lead into it, is from the incredible Broadway Tony Award-winning musical for Best Book of a Musical. My guest has won that, Tony. Dear Evan Hansen is the show, of course. Not the typical song that most people would open a discussion with him about, but I love that song so much I wanted to do it. But Stephen Levinson is responsible for a heck of a lot more. We're going to talk about it, including a current show called If I Forget that is playing at the Victory Gardens Theater through July 7th. And we'll be joined a little bit later by some of the cast members. This is going to be a very cool interview. And let me get right to it. Stephen Levinson, you are amazing. Can I just start off by saying that?
Oh, thank you. That's very nice.
So, Dear Evan Hansen was one of my first introductions to you, and it's taken over Broadway and now touring over the country. I have to tell you, I was in Cleveland last week. I thought, I'm going to go see it one more time, because why not, for the fifth time. Could not get a ticket, totally sold out. Thankfully, my connections to the office in New York got me a ticket, so I got to see it anyway.
Oh, great.
With the traveling cat. Oh, they were not going to keep me out. But You know, as I look at all of your work together for a moment, not just that show, but If I Forget, which we'll talk about, but Days of Rage, and we'll get to the TV stuff, but there you deal with it. It's rebels, it's people who are troubled. There is kind of a thematic aspect to the work you do, or am I misreading that?
Oh, that's so interesting. You know, I've never really thought about it that way. The thing that I think of consciously, at least, is I recognize that I'm very drawn to telling family stories. I'm very drawn to, you know, both typical families or traditional families, like the Fishers and If I Forget, and also, you know, in Days of Rage, which you mentioned, yeah. the sort of family of activists and outsiders. But that is really interesting. I guess I do always like those characters, for sure.
Well, now we put you on a path, so every show you do has to fall into that category, or you'll make me a liar.
Yeah, absolutely.
We can't have that. And so Evan Hansen, his mom, we've got the missing dad there, the other family. I'm not going to even spend too much time on the plot of that show, because people who listen to this podcast would be very well aware of Dear Evan Hansen. But, of course, you had some colleagues in writing the music of that show and the lyrics. It came together so beautifully. Can you give me a little history? Because I've got the book of the show, but did your book come before the music pieces? How did that develop?
Yeah, the way it all started was Benj Pasek, who's one of the songwriters, yeah. He, I'll give you the quick version of it. He had an incident in his high school a long time ago. When he was a junior in high school, a fellow student died of a drug overdose. And it was a student who otherwise was sort of an outsider, didn't have a lot of friends, wasn't very popular. And then in the aftermath of his death, Benj sort of witnessed this student kind of become the most important person at school. And you know, people wanted to claim that they had relationships with him that they didn't necessarily. They, you know, everybody was suddenly his best friend secretly, or his pal that, you know, they were friends when they were younger. Everybody had a story about him. And Benj was sort of fascinated by that kind of posthumous fame, or people seeking to glom onto this tragedy and put themselves in the middle of it. It was kind of fascinating. And fast forward many years, he kind of held that idea to himself is something that he was intrigued by and felt like there was possibly something musical about it. And he and Justin Paul began working together in college, writing musicals. And they brought this story to the producer, Stacey Mindich, who basically said, I want to work on, you know, your next musical, whatever you want that to be. I want to do what you're most passionate about. And they said, we have this kind of, you know, idea that we're not really sure what it is, but we are intrigued by and we want to figure it out. And they read a bunch of playwrights and they met some people and we really clicked. And they told me about this idea and we started working on it. And that was 2011. And we really, you know, we came up with this story and these characters together. And yeah, it was a long, it was about a 5-year process, which I think is pretty typical for a musical. But it was something that when we first started talking about it and for a very long time after that, it was an idea that we were really passionate about and we felt like we could see something there, but we really had no idea what the show would become. And we thought we were writing something very niche and very small. And our producer certainly did too. You know, it's like we always say it was the worst pitch for a musical ever. like it doesn't sound like the making of a popular show to say you're going to make a musical about teen suicide and a character
and
who
in
doesn't
fact,
tell
I'll,
the truth.
I'll tell you, sometimes there are people who are afraid to go see the show, and I often have to tell them, like, no. The sad part happens really quickly, and it's fine. You'll be fine with this. A friend of mine in Cleveland, where the show is has just played, wrote me right afterwards, and she said, this is one of the best shows I've ever seen in my life. And she was one of those who was pausing for a moment because of what she expected. So, no, it's very uplifting, actually. And
totally.
And the other thing you probably do know, but I do a show called Backstage, and I worked with the cast of the Chicago cast here. And Ben Ross talked about the fact that every night he's greeted by people at the stage door who want to tell them their story. The "You Will Be Found" piece. It's making that much of a difference. I know Ben Platt probably went through the same thing. I worked with Ben during Book of Mormon. Now he won't take my calls, and and that's probably thanks to you and Evan Hansen. So tell him I said hi, will you?
I will.
But anyway, so, and then of course, Mike Faist, who was in that show, you work with again in Days of Rage. So you also seem to, do you have people in mind? I mean, I do believe Ben Platt was kind of in your head when this was planning. I'm guessing maybe Mike was, or did you kind of fall in love with them, working with them, and then you said, we need to do it again?
Yeah, that was more of the latter. I mean, with Ben, with actually the whole cast, you know, we did, I think we were probably 2 or 3 years into developing the show, and we did a reading of it. And the moment we were really digging into the story, Benj Pathak said, I know this guy that I think would be perfect for this. He had actually come in, Ben Platt, and auditioned for Benj and Justin's musical Dogfight in New York. And was, ironically, it was a show about 17 and 18-year-olds, but they were casting it with, you know, 27-year-olds. And Ben, who was 17, was too young. But they remembered him and they remembered seeing something very special about him and felt like, oh, we may have a part for you. And so I met all those actors just in readings and workshops and fell in love. And really the show, as often happens, I suppose, you know, it's in the rehearsal process. It's working with those actors that the show evolves around them and with their voices and with their personalities. And Days of Rage 2 was not something that I wrote with Mike in mind, but, you know, when he wanted to do it and I was, you know, jumped at the opportunity to work with him again, of course.
We're going to stay in the theater world, but I'm going to leave it for a moment because I have to sort of tip my hat to you, not only for Masters of Sex, for which you were one of the writers through its 4 seasons.
Yes.
Talk about a risky show that Showtime put on. And again, everything they do takes a risk. But I have been obsessed with Fosse Verdon. And I want to tell you that because when I first saw that was the next up in that kind of series of shows, I thought, what are they doing with that? I got sucked in on the first show. Absolutely amazing. Can you just give me a little bit of the history of what took you into creating Fosse Verdon as the miniseries, which is phenomenal?
Yeah, I was so fortunate to I met Tommy Kail, the director
of Hamilton fame.
Yes, and we met about right around when Dear Evan Hansen was in New York. had just started on Broadway. And we met just, you know, we knew all the same people and had just never really connected. And we finally did. And he started to tell me about this book that he was attached to direct a limited series of for FX. And the book was Fosse. And he was sort of, you know, looking for a writer. And I would have done anything to work on that show as soon as I heard about it. And, you know, as anyone who works in the theater in any capacity has some relationship to Bob Fosse, I think, and has a personal story about how that work has impacted them or affected them, or at least I did. And it was really in working on that show and as we began to unpack that story and as we met Bob Fosse and Gwen Verdon's daughter, Nicole, that we began to understand that it was bigger than just Bob Fosse. And in fact, the most interesting part of the story for us was this, you know, absolutely unique, strange, fascinating relationship between Bob and Gwen, who was just so instrumental to all of that work, and whose contribution to the work and whose presence in that work has been largely, I think, overlooked. And certainly I didn't know anything about Gwen Verdon when we started. I'd seen Damn Yankees a long time ago, but it was really a learning experience for me too. And it was just a complete joy from start to finish. You know, it was one of these things that everyone that worked on that show in any capacity, you know, was much like me. As soon as they heard Bob Fosse and Gwen Verdon, they jumped at the opportunity to be involved. And so it was just a real labor of love for everyone involved.
Just, well, absolutely incredible. And just congratulations on that. And of course, one of the producers, actually, he makes a cameo in that, is Lin-Manuel Miranda. And once Lin comes into your life, that's the end of your life, because now there's no limit to what you're going to do. So let me just quickly touch base with you. Tick, Tick, Boom. Are you working on that with Lin-Manuel Miranda, the film?
Yes, I am. I wrote an adaptation, a screenplay that is going to go to Netflix at some point, or Netflix has come on board to produce it, I guess is the word you'd use. And hopefully we are, you know, Lin will be shooting that some point next year or
Perfect.
So, whenever his very free schedule opens up.
Yeah, and I know Ron Howard, Brian Grazer producing it, so whoever heard of them.
Right.
And that's going to be incredible. And then am I also right that you are working with Benj and Paul on a film version of Dear Evan Hansen?
Yes, we are. That is true.
Wow.
So that's another exciting, crazy thing that, yes.
I told
I don't
you.
Know the timeline on that either.
All right. Well, we'll keep in touch about that.
And I want to,
by the way, I collect Broadway props. So I actually do have one of the casts from when Ben was in the
fantastic.
Show. Yeah. So I'm all about keeping props from the show. So when you next go see it, steal something for me. So currently playing at Victory Gardens Theater. And what led to this, this discussion today is a show called If I Forget, which I'm proud to play a role as a part producer of, and, didn't know much about it when I first saw it. Then I saw it was you. And I went, let me check this out. It also blew me away. It runs about 2.5 hours. I'm going to bring the other cast members in and let them tell the story from their perspective. And then we're going to do some fun stuff. Daniel Cantor plays Michael Fisher. He's the son of the Fisher family. And playing his sister, one of two, is Elizabeth Lado. She plays Sharon. So Daniel and Elizabeth, welcome to this discussion. I hope you've been enjoying listening to Stephen.
Thank you very much.
So, I have been enjoying.
Yeah. So, Daniel, you're kind of the troublemaker of the family. Well, not really. It depends on the perspective. But
it depends on your perspective.
Exactly. So, tell us what If I Forget is all about. We'll see. We'll let Stephen step in if he disagrees.
Oh, my God. I'm sure
pressure.
Can do better job of summarizing than I can. But it's about three adult children of a Jewish-American family that grew up around D.C. And they're... the tensions of their family dynamics surrounding the death of their mother, which happens before the play begins, and then later the aging of their father. Michael is a Jewish studies professor, and he's written a book that is highly controversial and gets him in a lot of hot water and has sort of a cascading negative effect on his life. So I don't want to give anything away.
Yeah, I hear you. Other than we can add in that Michael's father.
That was very good.
Yeah, Michael's father and Sharon's father is in this show, so we get a very different perspective on life as it relates to this book. And Sharon, there are three kids, so describe for us, because they're very different kids, and it's almost, if it went a certain direction, we can turn it sitcom. But talk about these three kids. They're very different.
Sure, there's moments of that, right? No, yes. Well, Sharon is the youngest of the three, and anyone who is one of three siblings knows that dynamic is fraught. There's just the three sibling thing. Parents, God love ya. It's a danger zone. And you just get into that kind of stuff. But she's the youngest. She's unmarried, no children. The only one of the three is not married and has no children. So therefore, also lives nearby the parents. So she has taken on the role of kind of overseeing the parents. You learn in the play that she has felt and believed that she was the primary caretaker of her mom through the process of her sickness and death, and is concerned that she will play that role with her father, and is kind of ready to kind of start her own life, even though she's in her late 30s. So there's just, you know, all three of them. It's really fascinating, actually, because you mentioned, Stephen, that about process, about being in rehearsals with and these actors and how that happens. And it's my favorite part of doing this work is process. I love performing, too, but I really love process. And one of the fascinating things, and Dan, jump in but it was within the first week and a half, we had a really short rehearsal process for this, and this is heavy material, lots of technical challenges and certainly emotional challenges and lots of things like that, why it's such a fantastically written play. The three of us actors were, I swear to God, adopting this sibling relationship in the rehearsal room as actors, you know, fighting for ourselves, like being like, well, listen, I know that's what you think, but really that's not really what happened. So, and we were saying this as actors and we were fighting for our characters in such an interesting way. And it was completely, and Devin, our director, she was so good about navigating that as a director, but almost as a bit of a parent. Us, and I found that really fascinating, and I don't know if I was able to articulate that for myself until we kind of all started to groove in together and get it, you know, there was like this, there was a simpatico thing happening, but for sure, I would say that first week and a half, and Dan jump in, but I just was like, weren't we just kind of like fighting for ourselves?
Well, I mean, you know, life imitates art, as they say. I mean, you know, part of the actor's job is to, you know, justify the logic of their character and empathize with their point of view. So I think to some extent that's natural in a rehearsal. At the same time,
That we were behaving like siblings at times.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
You're doing it now.
It happens.
I know,
here.
I'm interrupting him like we do in the Fisher family.
I wasn't going to say this. I mean this with love, but I love the way I thought of you in your character for a moment, because I love the way you're saying, Dan, jump in, as you kept talking. And
I know.
So, and Dan, we will come to you, but Stephen, I have to ask you, first of all, here's what I didn't know. Dear Evan Hansen, which I certainly would tell people, it is reflective of, sadly, life experiences of many people and whatever. I did not know it was based on such a truthful story in Benj's past.
Yeah.
So let's come to If I Forget. Is this a fictional family to you, or are we kind of seeing people in your lives on that stage?
It's a little bit of both. It's, you know, there are
and who are you?
There are parts of the story that are based in sort of some reality, like my family is from the Washington, D.C. area, and my grandfather owned a store in D.C. that was actually burned down during the riot in 1969.
Oh, wow.
So it's like sort of true. And a lot of I have two siblings. I have a younger brother and an older sister, but a lot of the dynamics are, you don't realize that you're writing, or at least for me, I don't realize that I'm writing things that are, you know, from my life until I see them. And then suddenly it becomes kind of obvious, you know?
Can you talk about the father, Lou, because your dad, I think, would not be old enough. Lou, in this show, Lou is a World War II
the
vet. And of course, the play actually takes place in the Bush versus Gore era of that election, which that brings back good memories. But anyway, so who is Lou? Was Lou based on a character in your life?
Not really.
Okay.
No. You know, Lou, some of the story as it developed, you know, a lot of different threads came together when I was writing this play of things that I had been thinking about for a long time. And one of them was this story that I had read about Dachau that is, you know, that is in the play. I don't want to give too much away, but this event that happened with Dachau with the liberation of the liberation of the camps there by the American GIs. And that was some of the beginning of that character for me was actually that historical event. So that is not, he's actually not super autobiographical.
Okay. Which is interesting. So we talk about the dynamics between the siblings. Well, I'm going to play a little clip from the show so we can actually see how it plays out on stage. And then Daniel, Elizabeth, I'm going to turn it over to you and I'll let you to ask the playwright some questions that you might have been pondering about. So first, here is just a little clip that might be of interest to Stephen as well from If I Forget.
Fantastic.
Is your first book?
Third book. The other ones have been a lot more specialized, so.
Unreadable.
Well, I wouldn't say that, but.
I would.
They weren't intended. They were written for academics. They were not meant for a general audience.
What's this one about?
Do we really have to have this conversation?
What conversation? What did I do now?
It's just I'm not good at the two sentence, like, this is a book about, you know, I hate that.
It doesn't have to be two sentences. Who said two sentences? What is he talking about?
It's Jewish history. It's about Jewish history.
Well, that was two sentences.
Have you read it?
No, he won't let me.
I love it. You know, Dave, when I listen to that clip, but also when I watch the show, Stephen, I'm going to kick it off with a question, and Daniel, go to you. There is a David Mamet style rhythm to some of the dialogue to me, and I'm just curious, has Mamet been an influence on your career at all?
Not really.
Okay.
I don't know. You know what? I have to say, the thing that rings most autobiographical to me is my family, we talk over each other so much, and everyone talks at the same time, and that's for me, I think that's just like the rhythm that I hear.
It's Mamet. It's Mamet in real life. Daniel, what would you like
exactly.
to ask? What would you like to ask the playwright, Daniel?
Well, you know, can I just comment on the Mamet thing really quickly, and then
sure.
I have a question about another influence for Stephen. I think that there is a commonality that I see, which is that at least this play, If I Forget, has a kind of hyper-realistic writing style.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the way we actually speak is we interrupt ourselves, we're going in one direction, and then in a clause we change the direction rather than always being continuous in the thought. And Stephen's written that way, and I think Mamet writes that way, too, a little bit, in a lot of this work.
Yeah.
I see a commonality. But Stephen, I had another question about influence for you, and I probably am totally projecting this onto the play. But, you know, one thing I enjoy about the play is the sort of combination of humor. The play is very funny, sort of intellectual rigor, and real, like, relatable pathos, human pathos. Like, they're all combined together in great sort of contradictions. And it reminds me of Chekhov, to me. And particularly, the store feels like it's the cherry orchard, like the thing that you have romanticized, but that you ultimately have to let go of. Like, circumstance and survival just demands that you let go of it. And I'm wondering if that's just, I'm projecting that parallel, or you had that in mind, or that ever occurred to you?
You know, I didn't have that in mind, but I did. I had that thought when I saw it finally. Like when the production happened, I realized how much it did put me in mind of the Cherry Orchard specifically, which is my favorite Chekhov play. That's very flattering. What I love about Chekhov and what I hope that this play does too is that combination of all of those things that you're talking about and the kind of, you know, the mundane, the humor and the tragedy of the mundane, you know.
Exactly.
Stephen, I have to ask you, is it kind of a freak out situation? So here you are doing your work and now we're throwing all sorts of things like you're Mamet, you're Chekhov, you're whatever. And you sit back going, what is with these people? I'm just writing my shows.
No, you know, I think it's one of the coolest things about writing is that you don't, I mean, at least this is something I believe about writing, which is that you don't know what's inside of you all the time, you know, and you write things that surprise you, and people find things in the writing that you didn't think were there, and maybe you put them there, and maybe you didn't. Maybe that was just, what people found. But I think that's what's so exciting about theater, and, you know, specifically is that it can become so much more than just this one person's vision, you know?
Yeah. Or you could do what I do.
I will say that, you know, Elizabeth and I have done a couple Chekhov plays together, and throughout rehearsal, we kept saying, like a Chekhov play. This is like a Chekhov play. We kept saying it to each other over and over.
Elizabeth, let me go to you.
That's fascinating.
Let me let you ask a question to Stephen, Elizabeth.
Yeah, well, I do have one. It's a really specific question, but I want to say too that what I love that people are saying about this play too, that are coming, they're saying that like there's something there for everyone. You have so many themes in this play, and which can be challenging to actually give each of them their own weight, or to not feel like an audience member goes in and goes, listen, that's part of my story, but he didn't fulfill that for me, or
right,
that wasn't
right,
fulfilled.
Right.
And I haven't heard any of that. Everyone's like, look, it's all, things are touched upon and brought in, and the thread's there, and the thread's given a good amount of weight, and it's respected, and it's flushed out. And I think that that's such a wonderful, that's such a challenge to do, because you really do. You put a lot in here. And, you know what I mean? But no one's going, that was just dropped in for dramatic. That was just dropped in to change the course of this. And that's bullshit.
You.
You know, are we allowed to cuss? Sorry about that. I do it anyway.
Yes.
Anyway.
Radio, go ahead.
Sorry about that. Anyway, I just want to thank you for that. And I just want to thank you on behalf of audiences that have come and have shared that with me. So my question, because you brought up the Dachau thing, someone told me that I've been to the Holocaust Museum in D.C., but I don't know, I don't know this story, but someone has said that in the area where it is about Dachau, there's a picture, and one of the American liberators is named Lou. It's one of the first pictures you see. Was that anything about this? Somebody told me that, and I'm like, I wish I could ask the playwright that. So
no,
I'm sorry,
that's amazing.
Boring, but that's the question I need to ask.
Fascinating.
We've done it again. We've hit Stephen with a connection he didn't.
That one of the first when you go in, and one of the first pictures that's up has a group, and there's a guy standing on a Jeep, and his name's Lou.
Cool.
And he was one of the liberators, and they were just like, did that influence? And I'm like, I have no idea. But if I ever have a chance to talk to him, I'll ask him. So I had to. I know, isn't that?
That's so interesting.
You know, you could
know.
You could just do what they do in modern politics. Take the credit for it. By the way, that's something I found really amazing, is that, again, while the story takes place years ago in the Bush versus Gore days, so to speak, but I got to tell you, and I was sitting with a member of Congress that night. We stayed after for a very long time talking, dialoguing, the way the show ends, which is sort of poetic. I was going to say prophetic. It may be both. But you really trigger a dialogue. And I guess so, Stephen, I want to ask you, is this the story about the Jewish partially dysfunctional family going through that, who then have this political layer put on top of it with regard to the book that that Michael has written? Or was the impetus of this that underlying political theme that just happens to be taking place in this dysfunctional family?
That's a really good question. I think for me, ultimately, it's about these people and this family, but I wanted it to be the way all of our lives are, threaded through with the politics and with the history. And it's sort of a play that questions, you know, whether history is something that can be forgotten, and whether history is something that we carry, whether or not we know it, which was what was really interesting to me about Jerusalem and this idea of like Jerusalem syndrome, which comes up in the play of, you know, is there something in real? Is there something intrinsically, objectively real that connects us to places and histories, or is it all just storytelling and it can be taken or left as we see fit? And it's sort of a big open question. I mean, I will say about the politics, one of the interesting things about the play is it started in New York a few months after the election, and I was working on it right before the election with the director, Dan Sullivan, the summer before the election. And I'll never forget, we were sitting there talking about it, and I said, I wonder what the play is going to feel like after the election. And we were both talking about how Hillary Clinton is going to win and how that would feel. And I remember Dan said, well, and if Donald Trump wins, then who cares? It doesn't really matter anyway. as a joke, you know, like, wah. And so it was a very surreal thing when that actually was what happened. And it made the play, I think, more complicated for me than I had realized. In that, in a very short, so much of the play and so much of Michael's argument is that being Jewish is kind of optional at this point, or that you know, a lot of this history can be forgotten, it can be tossed aside, except for, you know, we don't want to, and suddenly it felt like, oh, history is not really as easily forgettable as I realized, you know. Especially, it felt like, oh, anti-Semitism is not just a story that we're telling ourselves. It actually is still very real. And that was kind of challenging, you know, but in a good way. I mean, as good as it can be.
Yeah, listen, it's the reality is you began writing this way before any of the current life we're living through. So
that's right.
Yeah, maybe that is the prophetic piece. If I Forget is playing at Victory Gardens Theater through July 7th. You do not want to miss it. It's one of the best shows I've ever seen. I'm a musical guy a lot, but when it comes to straight plays and stuff, this was amazing, mesmerizing. And I would look around the theater, and I got to tell you, Stephen, and I'm sure Daniel and Elizabeth see this every night. You know, sometimes you see people nod off. You see, not in this show. This show grafts people from the minute it begins. I remember, I'll also look at my watch sometimes. On this show, I didn't want it to end. I just wanted to see these dynamics continue. So with a mazel tov and a congratulations to Daniel Cantor and Elizabeth Lado. Yeah. And Stephen Levinson, for the work that you do, and I think both Daniel and I would say, if Aaron Lazar does not want to play the dad in the movie of Dear Evan Hansen, either of us would take that role.
Hey, what about me? Come
well, we were going to cast you as the mom. I'm going to cast you as the mom in Dear Evan Hansen, so it'll work. My thanks to all of you guys. Don't miss If I Forget at the Victory Gardens Theater. And to all of you, Daniel, Elizabeth, and Stephen especially, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Indeed, The Origin of Love, one of the beautiful songs from the rock musical Hedwig and the Angry Inch, playing over at Theo Ubake Cabaret Theater up in Evanston, one of my favorite theaters in the city. I just love that place because of everything that is unique about it. We'll talk about that. But this show, made famous off-Broadway and on-Broadway by John Cameron Mitchell, is going on there at Theo Ubake with an incredible cast playing through July 28th and a great director. Let's say hi to all of them. First of all, playing the role of Hedwig Schmidt is Will Liedtke. Will, welcome. And this is your first time at Theo Ubake, right?
Yes, it is indeed. Thank you for having me. But yeah, no, it's my first time. It's really exciting. I haven't experienced anything quite like it
before. Yeah, not only the show, but that space. I mean, to be there for the first time, it's such an intimate space. And of course, you're not one of the servers. I love the fact that the cast is also serving dinner, so that as I was eating, I had to say, okay, you have a show to do. Go ahead. But anyway, it was just great. And playing the role of Yitzhak, I'm saying Yitzhak because that's kind of the culture in me, but Yitzhak is the way y'all see it in the show, is Brittany Brown. Brittany, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And you have been at the Ubake. In fact, I'm fairly sure I saw you in Sweeney Todd, right?
Yes, I did Sweeney.
Yes, and I've seen you in Bonnie and Clyde. I've seen you in other stuff, too. But you were just great in this
awesome
role, and which, of course, has just done amazing on Broadway. And bringing it all together is the incredible director, Toma Langston. And Toma, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you for having us.
Hey, Toma, I'm going to start with you. So I last saw this show on Broadway with Neil Patrick Harris. And, of course, he was followed by Andrew Rannells and Darren Criss. And why am I drawing a blank on our friend from 6 Feet Under? But anyway, so incredible cast on Broadway. It comes here. It doesn't play around a lot. Talk to me about the challenge of putting this kind of show on almost in the round. It's almost like that.
Yeah, but
as you spoke to earlier, like the theater space is very, very intimate, and they're known for taking kind of like larger productions and really stripping them down to play for an audience and in the round. It was very, very challenging. I think probably the biggest challenge was taking the off Broadway script and kind of making it our own, which I think we did very well.
Yeah, I agree with you. And Will, so, I mean, you've been Seymour in Little Shop of Horrors, Snoopy, and You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. Those are kind of family-friendly sort of roles and whatever. And then, not that Hedwig isn't, but boy, what a different kind of role, and it's a challenge to your vocal cords, I'm guessing. Tell me about Hedwig, what this story is about, and then how we bring them to life.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is by far, like, you know, one of the most challenging things I've ever done in my career. And so I'm super grateful that we got a chance to tell the story in such an intimate setting and really explore the relationship between Hedwig and the audience, because that is so much of what I think she wants in her life is just validation. And, you know, her whole search in the show is finding her other half. And I think what's beautiful about the show and why I'm so excited and grateful to tell this story to people is that you are complete. Like as who you are, you don't need anyone else to fill that void for you.
So true. And Brittany, in playing Yitzhak, which the fact that the actor who played it on Broadway won a Tony, don't let that put any Jeff pressure on you. But but also, it's an interesting role. And I have this memory. We sort of know who you are. And maybe, Toma, you can correct me. But I think, Brittany, I have this memory that at least in the early days of the show, people assume that the actor playing Yitzhak is a male. And I even seem to have a memory that we didn't even know who that actor was initially, that it was almost a reveal during the show. Brittany, do I have that right, or am I misremembering that?
I think that typically, like, in order to kind of blur the binary gender lines, it's usually a male, but always played by a female.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's definitely been something interesting to kind of take into account with playing this role. And then, getting to discover, like, within the show how Yitzhak, used to be a drag queen, and, that was, where his passion lied, and he kind of had to give that up in order to have a life with Hedwig. So it's like all of those kind of factors playing together. But yeah, you are correct.
And Toma, I'm going to do a shout out here. They didn't join us for this interview, but Jacob Gilchrist and Adriana Tronco, you have them playing.
Yeah.
They play about a million roles each in this show. Never leave. I don't think I guess they leave stage just for moments to change costume, but they're almost always on. So give a shout out in terms of the direction of working with a very small cast of four other than the band, but really putting a challenge on Jacob and Adriana, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was when I originally... for when I first read Hedwig years and years and years ago, I always kind of saw it as a monologue with music. And so it always made sense to me, even with knowledge with the movie, like why we didn't see these kind of figures on stage. So the idea actually came from Jeremy Ramey, who said, why don't we add some backing vocals to it? And I said, well, if we're going to do that, why don't we put them in the scenes, put them in the monologue? And also to kind of like represent that, the male-female kind of body and Hedwig kind of like always being in the middle of that.
Yeah, and by the way, Jacob, and it's not hidden from his bio, but he's, for folks who know some of the more well-known drag artists in the city, he's Mickey Mirage. So we kind of know who he is anyway. So that's really cool. Will, in taking on a role like this, I got to tell you. Oh, I got to say one other thing. When you come in, there are earplugs available for everybody in a big bowl, and it kind of, I hadn't thought about it, but it kind of scared me. Oh, what am I in for and stuff? But you know what? It's not that loud, Will. It's just fine. I didn't use them.
Great.
Of course, I can't hear a word you're saying right now, but other than that.
You can hear everything.
Right. No, I mean, so do you, I'm just curious, Will, because you are so close to the audience, you especially, do you get, and the night I was there, I mean, there were some younger people, there were some older people, and Theo Bouquet does get sometimes of a middle-aged, older crowd, people who've just been going to that theater for a long time. Do you ever get anybody mm-hmm. and you see them with the earplugs in? Is it impacting everybody? Because I thought it was great.
Yeah, last night, actually, I saw a few people plugging their ears during some of the louder, you know, because there are some really heavy hitting numbers.
I guess.
I will say, you know, that's kind of the point, is that, you know, it's a loud rock show. So and those moments, I think, are important, that they are loud and in your face. So, and then there's people who are just jamming out. So you get a really nice mix of like people who are shocked by it and also people who are familiar with the show and long-term fans, which is really exciting to see people who like know the words and sing along. And it feels like a community coming together.
And I don't want to give too much away, but let's just say, and this was true in the Broadway show as well, Hedwig does play a little bit with audience members from time to time. And so the night I was there, everybody was in good spirits. They kind of played along. I'm just curious, does everybody, I'm assuming everybody always plays along and has some fun, even though apparently you might be meeting them on some dating website or something.
You know, it depends on the night. You know, I've had some nights where they're totally game and some nights where they don't want anything to do with it.
Really?
It's interesting. And I think, you know, like I was always that person where like if someone came up to me for audience participation, I'd be so terrified. So I understand that. But I think the exciting part about moving forward with this is getting more comfortable in the show, in the characters, so that like even when people throw a curveball at you, you know, you like I'm just getting more comfortable with it.
I was actually I was hoping you'd come to my table and pick me, because I was prepared to go, wait, I think that actually did happen. Wait a minute. So Brittany,
yeah, I mean, there's so many people that you can like develop little relationships with throughout the show. The ones who are like on board. Toma mentioned to us in rehearsals and like during previews, like finding the allies in the room. And that really helped put things in perspective for me.
Yeah, maybe it's why I stayed away from me. I was scary. Hey, Brittany, in your role, one of the things I think is amazing that I noticed more in this production than I ever did in the Broadway production, there are times that Yitzhak doesn't even have to talk. There are facial expressions and things where, you know, I can't put 100% on the table of what I think Yitzhak is thinking, but you do an incredible job of sending a lot of emotion and almost some understory that goes along with a lot of those looks. There's a lot of history in that relationship that we don't necessarily even see displayed on stage. If I've got that right, what goes through your mind? How much thought have you given to the relationship between you and Hedwig before you're on stage?
Sure. So that was something that we really played a lot with in rehearsals, was really trying to carve out kind of our version of what the history of their relationship was, and trying to connect with each other on how best to relay that. Since there are a couple of times throughout the show where we do directly mention like how we met and such, but a lot of it is kind of just us conveying it in the way that we relate to each other on stage. And so, I love this show because it really makes it so that, especially since we're on stage the whole time, we have to be clicked into each other from the get-go. And I'm, kind of hanging off every word that Will has, because that's the only way to like stay truly connected for the entire 90 minutes. And, you know, there's so much that I'm thinking about, like in terms of how much of the information that he's saying, you know, is new for me to hear. How much of it is something I've heard a million times, and what am I sick of? What am I not? What do I love about, what do I love about her? Because there has to be a reason why I stick around. And so all of that is kind of playing out for me. And it's been such a great challenge in that respect as an actor, because, you know, I could probably count on one hand the amount of spoken lines I have, but the amount of reacting that I get to do has been such a great challenge for me personally.
Yeah, and it is a performance. And when you add that in, it's amazing. Toma, when I think of the message of this show, I mean, John Cameron Mitchell wrote this, obviously, you know, many years ago, but it's relevant today. But I'll let you tell me what your view as director of why this show is as relevant today, maybe even more so than it might have been in the past. I feel as though it's not necessarily Hedwig's story anymore. It's the story of a lot of people who may feel outcast by society.
Yeah, I mean, I think the story today really speaks to, am I anything, and if I and am I more than what society says in terms of my biological sex, right? Like, it's all about, you know, accepting other identities. You know, people feel so. Don't necessarily feel, you know, or identify with the binary gender roles that we have now. So, you know, it's all about me being comfortable and saying, you know, I don't fit with that. I fit with this. And I almost demand you to accept it, and I accept it. So I think that's what the show kind of has become for people today.
Well,
particularly genderqueer folk, I would say.
Oh, yeah, I think so. And Will, I'm just sort of curious, because again, depending on who's coming to the show, and it is certainly playing through the 28th of July, but do you get folks in the audience who sort of might really relate to those issues in their own personal lives? I'm just curious whether maybe they talk to you afterwards the show. It's actually for you or Brittany, but I'll start with you, Will. Afterwards, who just want to kind of share their experience with you and connect?
Yeah, that's been one of the most rewarding things so far about doing this show is like there's been a few people who've come up to me and spoke of their relationship with Hedwig, like, oh, this was the first, you know, videotape that I had as a kid, and I'd always play it when my parents were out. And yeah, there's like one person who mentioned that, and like I said earlier, people who are speaking along with me, like one person even knew all of the words that I was saying. And like who sing along to the songs, and like when I look at them, there's a connection, like there's a love in their eyes, and I don't know, just like it feels like it's bigger than one person's story. Which has been really eye-opening for me.
Yeah, I asked that, too. I became more sensitive to that because I did I do a television version of the show, which is called Backstage, and I work with the cast of Dear Evan Hansen. And Ben Ross, who plays Evan Hansen here in Chicago when he's on tour with it, talks about the number of people who wait for him after the show with their stories, with their, you know, connecting in such a personal way. Brittany, are you having that same experience with audience members?
Yeah, what's been really nice and, you know, kind of like what Will was saying, you know, people who come up to you and not just the normal, you know, great job tonight, which is always really nice to hear, especially from, you know, people that you don't know, but, you know, people sharing how much the show meant for them to see us up there. And I've had a great mix of people who have come up to me who have seen the show a bunch and were just like, this production really spoke to me, but also a nice mix of people who didn't know anything about it coming into it and left it feeling very connected to material that they didn't realize they would have such a visceral reaction to.
Yeah, and tomorrow we should probably do another shout-out to Jeremy Ramey and the Angry Inch band members, because, you know, unlike many shows where we might take that band and put them on the side somewhere or put them out of sight, man, they are front and center.
Yeah, they're part of the whole theatrical experience, right? Like they're which is something that they did with the revival, which I really enjoyed and wanted to keep.
They did.
Jeremy's amazing.
He is, and of course, he actually does all. I think he is musical director for so many shows at Theo Ubuque. I just love the experience in that theater, and maybe and Will and Brittany, if you have a chance one night before you go on, have a dinner out front, and then go back and do your show, because you might as well experience that too, right? make Jacob and Adriana wait on you. It's a, why not? Hedwig and the Angry Inch. It's playing through July 28th at Theo Ubuque Theater. That's up in Evanston. It's a brand new location. I've seen every show there in the year or so that it's been located there. Absolutely amazing. I also want to make a perhaps unconscious connection between the bowl of sugar daddy suckers that are at the front door that you can take on the way in, and the song we're going to go out with as I listen to you, which, of course, you know what it is, Will. It is called it's called Sugar Daddy. And with my thanks to Will. See, is that it? All right, Tomah, was that an unconscious connection, or is that why Fred put that stuff up there?
Oh, that was part of all the design, yeah.
Okay. Well, I love it. I didn't kick into the next day. Anyway, Will Lidke, Brittany Brown, Tomah Langston, thanks so much. Don't miss Hedwig and the Angry Inch. Such a joy to have it here in the city through July 28th. And let's go out listening to a little bit of Sugar Daddy.
If you got some sugar for me, Sugar Daddy, bring it home.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes and tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.